MedCram.com.
Welcome to another COVID-19 MedCram update. Okay, let's discuss exactly what's going on right now with COVID-19. What we have here are three different populations. We have the entire population as a whole, and we have those that are going to be infected, and we have those that are going to need hospitalization. And you may have noticed that the situation that we're having right now in New York, especially also in other parts of the country, is that this population of people who need hospitalization is not able to get into our tunnel here, which is in fact the hospital. And because of that, we're having issues with shortages of ventilators, of ICU beds, etc. And so right now, all of the work is going into trying to increase the capacity of the hospital system to allow this type of bolus of patients, if you will, to get through and to be treated effectively. Now, of course, these graphs are not drawn to scale. Remember that there's only a certain amount of the population that will become infected, and the way to reduce that even more is with isolation. But there's a certain percentage of those people that become infected that will need to go to the hospital. And as it stands, according to the data that we have right now, that's about 20%. Which means that 80% of the people that get the infection won't need to go to the hospital. And that is almost totally related to that patient's immune system. So the immune system is rather complicated, and that's why I wanted to talk about it a little bit. Imagine your immune system is like this country's armed forces. You have the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force. They all have specific functions, but they all work together to protect the organism, to protect the country. Let's face it, there are a lot of threats that can happen to a human being. But in this case, the SARS-CoV-2 virus affects the human body in a very specific way. And so if we can learn what part of the immune system is being diminished, then we can learn potentially how to fight this virus effectively and reduce the number of people that might need to have hospitalizations. So enter this article where they actually look at the immune responses to not only this coronavirus, but the SARS-CoV-1 and the MERS coronavirus that was there previously. So this article was published in the Asian Pacific Journal of Allergy and Immunology. Immune responses in COVID-19 and potential vaccines, lessons learned from SARS and MERS. So let's take a look and see what they found. They do a comparison in the number of cases between those three viral infections. They also break down the demographics. And they show the issues here with the SARS-CoV-2, the current viral infection, in terms of the immune players that we were just talking about. And the thing that they bring up in this article, which is very interesting, is this first point here, which is delayed or suppressed type 1 interferon response during the initial infection. In fact, in the article, they say here, to mount an antiviral response, innate immune cells need to recognize the invasion of the virus, often by pathogen-associated molecular patterns. So remember what the innate immune response is. It is those cells that do not require a little piece of the virus to be presented to them. And so these are not T cells and B cells that are making antibodies, but rather innate cells. So these would be like macrophages, monocytes, natural killer cells. This would be like the Air Force of the armed services. And the things that activate them in this case are these PAMPs, or these molecular patterns that are associated with pathogens. In this case, for the coronavirus, it would be viral genomic RNA. They go on to say here that for SARS-CoV and MERS-CoV, the response to viral infection by type 1 interferon is suppressed. Both coronaviruses employ multiple strategies to interfere with the signaling leading to a type 1 interferon production. Watch what else they say here. With similar changes in total neutrophils and lymphocytes during COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2 probably induces a delayed type 1 interferon and loss of viral control in an early phase of the infection. What they're saying here is that the virus is able to downregulate your immune system in the early phase of the infection, and this may be the reason why most people with this infection are initially asymptomatic until the very end when there's a storm of cytokines. In addition, no severe cases were reported in young children when innate immune response is highly effective. This may explain why young children aren't getting the disease as severely. These facts strongly indicate that innate immune response is a critical factor for disease outcome. analysis of two MERS-CoV-infected individuals with different severity found that the type 1 interferon response in the poor outcome patient, which died, was remarkably lower than the recovered patients. So if we go back to our picture again, we see here that those patients that are ending up in the hospital are about 20% of those that actually get the infection. And the reason why we may want to say is that there is a decrease in the innate immunity. That is the specific problem with this virus. And this seems to bear out in a recent publication in Nature Medicine, where they looked at immune responses and cells in a patient that had non-severe COVID-19. In fact, this patient never needed to go to the hospital, and he recovered quite well. Of course, we'll link to this and the previous article in the description below. But what they did look at here was the amount of virus, the symptoms, the chest x-ray, and then even more importantly for our evaluation, these monocytes and natural killer cells. So here we have monocytes and natural killer cells. And if you look at this triangle here, you can see where the patient's monocytes were in relation to where they should be in a normal healthy patient. The monocytes, which are part of the innate immune system, were much lower than they should have been, even though this patient only had mild disease, reaffirming that it's the innate immune response that seems to be suppressed in these COVID-19 patients. And even more so, it seems monocytes and natural killer cells seem to be the target. So the question is what is it that we can do to increase the number of monocytes and perhaps gamma interferon to elevate that early in the course of this disease? And we've talked before about not treating a viral fever because we know that viral fevers are involved with the immune response as well. But I've gotten some interesting comments wondering if a patient with coronavirus doesn't have a fever, would inducing a fever improve the outcome and the immune response? So knowing what we know already about what's going on in COVID-19 in terms of depressed monocytes made this German publication back in 2002 even more interesting. And here are the authors, Zellner et al., says that thermal effect of fever has been associated with better survival and a shorter duration of disease in cases of infection. And what they wanted to do was to understand better what happened if they subjected 12 healthy volunteers in a 39.5 degree centigrade hot water bath to increase their body temperature and see what would happen to the expression of monocytes and tumor necrosis factor alpha, which is a cytokine that it releases. And they looked at this both in vitro and in vivo in humans that were actually put into a hot water bath. And what he found was that the in vitro data showed that definitely there was an increase in the monocytes. They say here that the expression of the endotoxin receptor CD14 and the complement receptor CD11B increased after a hot water bath. Furthermore, when they looked at the healthy subjects after they were put into the hot water bath, they said here, after 3 hours, the response of monocytes to endotoxin was enhanced. In an ex vivo lipopolysaccharide stimulation assay, which is basically a stimulant from a bacteria that might have infected a human body, when they stimulated the immune system, they noticed that there was greater TNF-alpha release, which was statistically significant. So they conclude that the thermal effect of fever directly activated monocytes, the very cells, interestingly, that are deficient in COVID-19. And that increased their ability to respond to, in this case, a bacterial challenge, but I'm sure they would be equally as responsive to a viral challenge as well. But this isn't the only study that shows this. There was an interesting article that was published around 2000 titled Immune Changes in Humans During Cold Exposure, Effects of Prior Heating and Exercise. They took subjects and they had them sit in a warm bath, among other things, and then they exposed them to cold to see whether or not that would also improve immunity. And you can see here for the 7 subjects in the white boxes, sitting in a 38 degree centigrade water bath increased their core body rectal temperature, and then after they were exposed to cold, there was a drop in the core body temperature. And here, when we see the data in this second set of bar graphs, which are the ones where they sat in 38 degrees centigrade water, you can see here for leukocytes, which are all of the white blood cells, that there was a significant increase in the number of white blood cells. Here also for the granulocytes, increase as well. For the lymphocytes, there was an increase. And also for the monocytes, there was an increase. Remember, the monocytes is the part of the innate immune system that's deficient, we're finding out in COVID-19. What they concluded in this report, despite popular beliefs that cold exposure can precipitate a viral infection, the innate component of the immune system is not adversely affected by a brief period of cold exposure. This is exactly the part of the immune system that we're talking about with COVID-19. They say, indeed, the opposite seems to be the case. The fall in core body temperature resulting from cold exposure led to a consistent and statistically significant mobilization of circulating cells, an increase in NK cell activity, natural killer, and elevations in circulating IL-6 concentrations. Moreover, in agreement with one of our hypotheses, prior exercise with a thermal clamp significantly augmented the leukocyte, granulocyte, and monocyte response to cold exposure. Prior passive heating and exercise without a thermal clamp also tended to augment the effect of cold exposure alone. But because of the small sample size and inter-subject variability, these changes were not statistically significant. So interestingly, what they're finding here is that, yes, heat can improve the immune system like we've seen before, but then subjecting them to cold, which goes against popular belief, can actually enhance the immune system, especially the innate immune system, which I find very interesting because that's the portion that's affected in COVID-19. So all of this talk about being hot and then cold reminded me of the Finnish saunas that are so famous in that part of the world, and actually in most of the Nordic countries, but not to the degree that we see in Finland. So here's a study that looked at a single Finnish sauna session on white blood cell profile and cortisol levels in athletes and in non-athletes. And in this study, they only looked at 9 people, which is kind of a low number, so we might not be able to see statistical significance, but let's see what they found. So for those of you who don't know what a Finnish sauna is, it's quite extreme. The sauna can go upwards of 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which is very close to the boiling point of water. During the sauna session, the human body is alternatively exposed to hot and cold stimuli. Hot air in the sauna room affects the skin and the respiratory system. This leads to a rise in body core temperature up to as high as 39 degrees centigrade, while the skin temperature might be as high as 42 degrees centigrade. And then after this is done, there is a fast cool down, and then they go back into the sauna to heat up once again. So what happened to the white blood cells in this situation? They found here that there was a statistical significant increase in the number of white blood cells, particularly more noticeable in the athletes than in the non-athletes. Some of these were statistically significant and some of them were not, possibly related to the low number of subjects in this study. They found here that a significant increase in monocyte count was accompanied by a significant increase in the number of neutrophils and eosinophils only in the athletes, which could have been caused by a reduced cortisol secretion compared to the untrained subjects. Remember, this is only after 1 session in the sauna. So let's take some stock about what's going on. We've got the infection that occurs here at this point in time. And then we have at this point in time, some of those, about 20%, will end up in the hospital with pneumonia secondary to cytokine storm, as it's been often called. Why is it that people are asymptomatic early on? And it may be that the immune system is being suppressed. Well, if we inflame the immune system, if we increase the immune system with thermal regulation and hyperthermia, is it possible that we could actually precipitate a storm situation and get the patient in the hospital sooner without actually helping out the patient? Well, that's a good question, and it's a possibility. And that's why I found this publication so interesting. They talk about this interleukin IL-6, which has been implicated in the cytokine storm that patients with pneumonia get when they had COVID-19. The paper is long, but I found this paragraph very enlightening. Although febrile temperatures initially increase the production of pro-inflammatory cytokines by macrophages at sites of inflammation, there is also evidence that thermal stress dampens cytokine synthesis once macrophages have become activated. This sequence of events is analogous to a natural fever, which often occurs after macrophages and other innate immune cells initially encounter PAMPs. Remember PAMPs from that first article that we looked at. In this regard, human monocyte-derived macrophages produce less TNF, less IL-6, and less IL-1 beta when exposed to febrile temperatures than heat-inexperienced cells. Heat reduces transcription of pro-inflammatory cytokines and also lowers cytokine mRNA stability. Thermal treatment of LPS-activated macrophages also appears to dial down inflammation. So what they're showing here is that fever can actually reduce the cytokine storm and improve the innate immune system. Now, they actually have a model of this with mice who have arthritis, collagen-induced arthritis. When they exposed the mice to fever range hyperthermia, they had significantly less joint damage. So they say that collectively, these findings suggest that strategic temperature shifts contribute to a biochemical negative feedback loop that actually protects the tissues against damage from excessive cytokine release following infection. Interesting. So in this period of time between when you have infection documented and hospitalization, if there were to be a higher temperature, it could improve the immune system, which seems to be hamstrung already, and it would reduce the cytokine storm potentially that's leading to pneumonia requiring hospitalization. Okay, so up to this point, we've looked at real people. We've looked at cells, though, as surrogates for a good immune system against viruses. Let's actually put it to the test. And here we have an article asking that very question. Does regular sauna bathing reduce the incidence of common colds? They took 50 people that had never been in a sauna before. This was an Austrian study, and 25 of them stayed out of the sauna and they were used as controls. The other 25 had sauna bathing to see if they could reduce the incidence of common colds. And what they found was this. In the 6 months' time that both groups were recording how many common colds they got, there was significantly fewer episodes of common cold in the sauna group. This was found particularly during the last 3 months of the study period when the incidence was roughly cut in half compared to controls. And so they concluded that regular sauna bathing probably reduces the incidence of common colds, but they felt that further studies were needed to prove this. And you always need further studies to make sure that what you're looking at is real. Here in an editorial, Dr. Ernst, who was the one responsible for publishing the sauna Austrian study, says here, "Nevertheless, it seems unwise to advocate sauna indiscriminately. Thus, whenever in doubt, a medical checkup is mandatory. Once this is done, sauna can be fun and relaxing." So we take Dr. Ernst's statement at its face value, but the question is a deeper one. Does this heat and then cold help prevent and treat coronavirus 19? Of course, the answer to that question is we don't know at this point because there hasn't been a randomized controlled trial looking at that specifically. But then again, there hasn't been a randomized placebo-controlled trial in anything that we're using for COVID-19 at this point. Now, I know this is a long video, but I needed to get some more in here because it's just so interesting. So this was a paper that was published back in 2016 by the Salk Institute, and very interesting review of all of the data that was pertinent to their study that looked at this idea of hyperthermia and hypothermia. This initial proposal made by Kluger in the 1970s only considered the fever response beneficial for host defenses. However, we suggest that both fever and hypothermic responses are strategies of the host to optimize host defenses during infection. Indeed, there is evidence to suggest that both fever and hypothermic responses are beneficial for the host in the context of an array of diseases. So the more I thought about this, the more I started to think about the Finnish sauna. Here is a population of people that use the sauna extensively. So here you have the Scandinavian countries of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. Finland's technically not a Scandinavian country, but they're all considered Nordic countries. And so they're all about in the same place. But while the Finns extensively use saunas on a regular basis, maybe even 2 to 3 times a week, Not so much so in Sweden and Norway and Denmark, although they are used to some extent. There's about 5.5 million people in Finland, and there's estimated to be about 2 million saunas. So I got this idea to look up some of these Nordic countries on Worldometer, realizing, of course, that even though they're very similar in nature, there could be some confounding variables that make them different. But if this kind of hot and cold that is being experienced, if this could help the innate immune system, and if in fact it's the innate immune system that is deficient in a COVID-19 case, then we would expect to see some sort of improvement if it was worthwhile. So let's look at some of the numbers. And so again, this type of a study really doesn't prove anything. It can be affected by when the virus started in each of these respective countries and where they are along the process, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens. So what I decided to do was take the different countries, so Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, and I put here approximately the population of each of these countries, so Denmark being 5.6 million. And so you can pull these numbers right off of Worldometer. What about total deaths? So this is an interesting question because perhaps if the immune system is amplified with the sauna and the cold bathing, maybe it wouldn't prevent you from getting the infection, but it might prevent you from going towards cytokine storm and getting a pneumonia. So we might see a difference in the total deaths. Let's take a look. And in Finland, 11. Interesting. What about total deaths per million? What about new deaths for today? It's going to be interesting to keep track of this data as things go on. There is another culture that also likes to have very hot baths and then cool down afterwards, and that is the Japanese. And in looking at their numbers, they're not doing too badly. Again, could be confounders, but we need to look at this from the microscopic level and the macroscopic level as well. Switching gears, I wanted to also talk to you about a new publication that's just come online regarding hydroxychloroquine. And this is by the same author that published the study that showed that the combination of azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine was effective. There was some criticism at the low number of patients in that group. Well, now he's updated his results with 80 patients, and basically the results are very similar. In conclusion, we confirm the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine associated with azithromycin in the treatment of COVID-19 and its potential effectiveness in the early impairment of contagiousness. Given the urgent therapeutic need to manage this disease with effective and safe drugs, and given the negligible cost of both hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, we believe that other teams should urgently evaluate this therapeutic strategy, both to avoid the spread of the disease and to treat patients before the severe, irreversible respiratory complications take hold. You can see here that black bar is the number of patients tested, and the tan bar here is the number of patients with a CT value of less than 34. It's the number of cycles that you have to do with reverse transcriptase PCR to actually get a signal. So what you really want here is a high, high number. That means that the RNA is undetectable. And so when you have a less than 34, that's a bad thing, and you want the number of patients with that to go down, and that's exactly what you're seeing here as it's going down. And in fact, it reaches zero around day 11 or so, and then you can easily see that with this green bar, which is the percentage of patients with a CT value of less than 34, and you can see that that's a good outcome there. A lot of stuff today, more to follow tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to another MedCram COVID-19 update. Yesterday, we looked at data that seemed to imply that hot and cold temperature regulation affected the part of the immune system, namely the innate immune system, that helps with targeting viral infections and foreign invaders. And this part of the immune system is particularly affected, especially in the SARS-CoV-2 viral infection, specifically natural killer cells and monocytes. And we showed some data that hyperthermia and then cooling off actually improved surrogates for the immune system in terms of the number of monocytes and their stimulation and response to foreign invaders. We also took the example of a sauna in terms of some of the data that's been done in terms of preventing viral infections. But the point was not to advocate specifically for sauna bathing or for anything in particular, but just ways that people's temperature can be elevated and then reduced. I think the ideal answer to this would be something that could be easily accessible for the majority of the world's population. And certainly, unlike Finland, we can't all have our own sauna. And so the purpose of today's video is really to get some practical solutions that answer the data that we've been given. So I encourage you to watch the whole video. Okay, I wanted to review again exactly what it is that's going on with this coronavirus infection. First of all, at day zero, when somebody becomes infected, there's about a 5-day period where there is no symptoms. We call that the incubation period. And let's say that of all the people that become infected, they won't show signs during those 5 days. And so this is at 100%. And then over the next 7 to 8 days, so by the time we get to day 12, there's going to be a pretty dramatic drop-off in the number of patients that are going to have issues, so that we are down to approximately, at this point, 20%. And the reason for this drop is really for one reason, and that's the host's immunity, your immune system. So we start off at 100%, drop down to about 20%. These 20% will need to be hospitalized because of pneumonia, shortness of breath, etc. And so they will go into the hospital at this point. The specific part of your immune system that is really hammering this virus and is the reason why 80% exit this cycle and they don't need any more care, it seems as though, based on the studies that we looked at last time, was because of innate immunity. And this is the portion of the immune system that is very strong in terms of taking care of these viral pathogens. It is the monocytes. It's the natural killer cells. Remember in our last video, we showed you that these monocytes, which should be up here in terms of frequency, are actually down here. They are impaired. We also showed you in this article the longer incubation period is probably due to their immune evasion properties, efficiently escaping host immune detection at the early stage of the infection. And that has to do with, again, these monocytes and part of the innate immunity. Look back at our last update for more information on that. We also showed how temperature, both hot and cold, could actually enhance this immunity. And the question is whether or not if we could figure out how to improve immunity, we could shift this curve down and actually have less needing to have hospitalization. Well, as it turns out, COVID-19 is not the only disease that requires monocytes as a key player in the fighting of its infection. Here's a paper that was published less than a year ago in Frontiers in Immunology. They go through and they actually note, these results demonstrate for the first time that intermediate monocytes control the differentiation of Treg substates in Treponema pallidum HIV-1 co-infections. New insights into an immunological mechanism involving monocytes and Tregs in HIV-infected individuals with syphilis. So the key here I want you to see is that there is an association with monocytes with syphilis, and that's very interesting because, as we showed last time, human monocyte stimulation by experimental whole-body hypothermia was augmented. And we could see here that 3 hours after in vivo hyperthermia, the response of monocytes was enhanced. But this shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone who knows the history of the treatment of neurosyphilis. As we know now, but they didn't know then, monocytes are involved with the treatment of neurosyphilis and also syphilis. And if we look here, there was a physician by the name of Julius Wagner Joreg. And what he found, interestingly, is that by stimulating the body to make a fever actually sped up the treatment of neurosyphilis. Well, how did he cause the patient to actually have a fever? By infecting him with malaria. Now, of course, we're not advocating to infect people with malaria. Remember, this was before penicillin. And as it's noted here in the article, they say actually malaria infection was an acceptable risk for patients as quinine would be administered as soon as the syphilis was cured. They also mention, interestingly, that for centuries, heat has been used in various ways for the cure of mental diseases. And even Hippocrates noted that malarial fever could have a calming effect in epileptics. It should also be noted that Dr. Wagner Jureg received for his work in terms of treating neurosyphilis the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Now, interestingly, the article goes on to show that the therapeutic regimen that was completed with the administration of quinine sulfate to terminate the malarial infection was done in the hospital under strict monitoring of patients' vital signs. And there's a number of ways of actually causing the patient to have a fever. They talk about the injection of foreign protein, parasitic diseases, chemical substances, but it's interesting what they end up on here, which is immersion of the individual in a hot bath or placing him in a heat cabinet. And this was used well into the 1950s. However, with the introduction of penicillin in syphilis's treatment, fever therapy effectively ended because now we had an antibiotic. And so one has to realize here that there was a major change in the way we did medicine in the United States and in the world. Instead of doing home remedies or these other things that were done as mentioned in this article, we went down a road of randomized placebo-controlled trials that were funded by companies that were able to make medications. Not to say there was anything wrong with that, because we've certainly derived a benefit in the last 50 to 60 years in this department. But the question is what's happened to some of these other potential treatments? And are any of these other treatments worthy of looking at once again? Remember our timeline. When a patient has symptoms at 5 days and goes to the emergency room, what is told to him is for him to go back home because he doesn't meet the admission criteria to go in the hospital. Meanwhile, the virus is making inroads on the patient and is suppressing the immune system until finally the house is fully inflamed and the patient is admitted to the hospital with pneumonia. And what we've been doing up to this point for COVID-19 in this country is we've been trying to improve and increase the resources at the hospital in terms of ventilators, in terms of rooms, in terms of medications, and in terms of staffing to meet that demand of 20% who will eventually need to be hospitalized. And the question that remains is there some simple remedy that could be investigated that would be available in someone's home that they wouldn't have to go to the store to buy, that a production company wouldn't have to deliver? Is there something simple enough that can reduce this curve enough to bring down the demand at the hospital and prevent this overwhelming tsunami of patients that require healthcare delivery? So this statement here, where it was used well into the 1950s, intrigued me. So I decided, based on the internet and all of the archives that we have available to us, to dig down deeper and figure this out. So there's probably no more illustrious character in the history of hydrotherapy than John Harvey Kellogg. This physician wasn't the inventor of hydrotherapy, but he was certainly its most ardent advocate. He also is the one that invented Kellogg's Corn Flakes. His brother was the entrepreneur who started the business. He wanted to change breakfast in the morning because of what people were eating at the time. It was all eggs and ham, and he was a health advocate. As an interesting side note, one of the people that visited him at the Battle Creek Sanitarium where he was presiding was a man by the name of Post, who took the idea, and the rest is history. He actually was the doctor to many famous patients, including President William Howard Taft. And you can see the rest of the list there, including Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. He wrote a 1,500-page compendium on rational hydrotherapy and the technique of their application in the treatment of disease. And I show this to illustrate a couple of things. Number one, just how quickly treatment can completely be obsolete and not practiced. In most hospitals in the United States today, hydrotherapy is not used at all in terms of an infectious disease standpoint. One must realize that this book was published decades before the discovery of penicillin and antibiotics. And so from an infectious disease standpoint, the randomized placebo-controlled trial in terms of medications that can treat and prophylax against infections has been the way that we have gone in the last 100 years. And of course, specifically the issue with COVID-19 is we have no randomized placebo-controlled trials at this point. The other point that this brings up is to clarify and to show what the state of affairs were in the other denominational sanitariums that were sister sanitariums of the Battle Creek Sanitarium at this time. So when we come back to our initial issue here of trying to bring down this curve, we are left with this situation. After 1950, we have a world where we live in randomized placebo-controlled trials and we're able to compare. Prior to 1950, we do not have that very often. Typically, there is physicians that are practicing based on observation, based on anecdotal evidence. Because of the drop of hydrothermal therapy from the scene prior to 1950, it is going to be very difficult to find a randomized controlled trial looking at hydrotherapy in a population base where we have people who are infected and are being treated. We have already shown in this update and in the last update some interesting findings that are surrogates in most cases, and in some cases, mild viral infections of little consequence like colds. The question, of course, is, can hydrotherapy or hydrothermal therapy or temperature regulation affect COVID-19 in any way, shape, or form? And unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever have that answer. What we can do is we can look at next best scenarios, and that's what we attempt to do next. So this is by no means a medical journal. In fact, it is a religious periodical published by the Review and Herald Publishing Company. But in its 1919 edition, there is an article written by Dr. Rubel, who was the medical director of the New England Sanitarium in Massachusetts. So this is what Dr. Rubel had to say in the height of the Spanish flu pandemic in the northeast of the United States. He says here that the infecting agent of influenza, whether germ or virus, has not yet been identified, and there is no laboratory method by which it can be differentiated from a common cold or bronchitis or other inflammation of the respiratory tract. Remember that Dr. Rubel is writing this prior to the discovery of DNA, prior to the electron microscope, and I find that his insights are quite valuable. The following are the principal methods of prevention. First, isolation of those who have symptoms of the disease from those who are well. Second, inoculation seems to have good effect in some cases, but its value is questionable. Third, each person should keep as well as possible by proper habits of eating, drinking, sleeping, exercise, and breathing. It's interesting that even at that time, they knew that sleeping was important. An important matter in treating the disease is to protect the patient from exposure, especially immediately following the cessation of abnormal temperature. Every subject of the disease should remain in bed as many days after the temperature becomes normal as he had a temperature in order to be sure to avoid a recurrence of a possible pneumonia. And then he goes on to talk about, in the Boston Medical Journal, millions of people that this influenza virus has taken around the world. And I want you to be understanding of a certain point. In these days, there was no intensive care units. There were no ventilators. There were no ICU nurses. There were no intensivists. And so if you got pneumonia, you had about a 50-50 chance of making it. The entire treatment at this point was to prevent you from getting pneumonia. I find that an interesting dichotomy because today, if you go to the emergency room, they will tell you not to come back until you do have a pneumonia, and then they can treat you with antibiotics, with an intensive care nurse, with a respiratory therapist, and if needed, a ventilator. The next part of Dr. Rubel's treatise is talking about the sanitarium treatment of influenza, which I find very interesting. So what Dr. Rubel describes is two situations, the situation in the army camps and the situation in the sanitariums in New England. And so the army camps, remember that these were soldiers coming back from the First World War and bringing with them, unfortunately, the Spanish flu epidemic, which became the pandemic. Now, Dr. Rubel doesn't report the actual number of cases, but he does have percentages. So we don't know the number of cases, but we do know that about 20% of the soldiers coming back in the army camps came down with the influenza virus. Those translated into cases of pneumonia, about 16%. They said about 1 in 6. And then from there, there was about a 40% conversion rate into deaths, which gives us a total of about 6.4% case fatality rate for the army camps. But over in the sanitariums, they were able to treat the inpatients with the hydrotherapy, but they were also able to treat outpatients. There was nothing special about being inpatient, and they tried to match the treatment with the outpatients. Remember, this is a time where they didn't have ICU beds, there was no ventilators, there wasn't ICU nurses. So a lot of the treatment could be done both in and outpatient at the same time. However, the outpatients may have differed a little bit from the inpatients in that they may have waited a little bit longer to be treated, whereas those in the inpatient side were treated immediately. So on the outpatient side, they recorded 677 patients, of which 55 cases got pneumonia, and that was about 8%. And then those 55, 26 of them died, which worked out to about 3.8% mortality. Now, the inpatient side, these patients were being treated in the sanitariums, and these might have been more likely to have been the doctors, the nurses who came down with symptoms in the sanitarium, and they knew what to do, and they started therapy right away. And so those had about 446, which led to 11 cases of pneumonia, which is about 2%. And that led to 6 that died, which was giving us a total mortality of about 1.3%. So of the 55 that went to 26 here in the outpatient, that was about 47%. And of the 11 here, 6 went to deaths, that's about 55%. So how would I interpret these results? Well, the first thing that I notice is in the army camp versus the sanitarium, the army camp would be where I would expect the best physicians, the best technique, and the best ancillary services. And for those patients that developed pneumonia, you can see here that the army had the best outcomes. However, how many actually developed pneumonia in this case? 16% developed pneumonia in the army camp, 8% as an outpatient, and 2% as an inpatient. You can see that the hydrotherapy or hydrothermal therapy, because they used hot and cold, was the best at reducing the incidence of pneumonia. And you've got to remember that in this day and age, pneumonia was a death sentence pretty much. And so everything was done to prevent the patient from getting pneumonia. You remember what Dr. Ribble said about making sure that the patient laid in bed and still so that they wouldn't get the secondary infections that caused pneumonia. Remember, this was before antibiotics. And you can see when this approach was taken, that the best mortality rate was patients that were treated for early in the sanitarium when they knew they would be treating them exactly according to the protocol. Second best was when they trained the facilities at home to take care of the patient. And then worst is when they weren't doing the hydrotherapy. And presumably these cases led extensively to a lot of pneumonia, which led to an excess case fatality rate. So that kind of brings us back to our graph. And here we have the population. And what we're trying to do is isolate, which is trying to prevent the number of people from getting infected, which is represented here by this first bar. Then we have symptoms, and there's about 20% of these people who are infected, which will end up at the hospital. And what we're trying to do there is increase the capacity at the hospital by getting ventilators, by making sure that our healthcare workers have personal protective equipment, by getting more beds, by getting nurses and respiratory therapists and ancillary services ramped up. But also, we are doing randomized controlled trials so we can have medications to treat people with. So we're working a lot here at this end, and that happens only when the patient comes to the hospital after they have shortness of breath and pneumonia. And we're doing a lot here at this end to make sure that only a small portion of the population actually gets the infection. And I think those are all important things that we should do. But when the patient comes to the emergency room here and is told to go home and not come back unless they have symptoms of shortness of breath, We are doing a lot of nothing in this period of time here when the immune system, I believe, needs help. And remember here, if we have a situation where 80% of the people who get the infection are going to do well, and it's this 20% that needs to come to the hospital, if we can just improve that immune function by a few percentage points, 5 percentage points, then what we're doing is we're only having 15% going to the hospital. If you can drop this 20 down to 15%, then that there represents a 25% reduction in the number of people needing ventilators, needing beds. What's also important here is that whatever it is that you need to do here, it has to be something that doesn't have to be produced. You don't have to go to the store to buy it. And the nice and interesting thing about hydrothermal therapy, if in fact this works, and we don't have randomized placebo-controlled trials that show us that it works, but if it does work, it's something that anybody can do. And with that, I just want to thank the viewers out there who've been watching these videos, because there's been a lot of feedback and there's been a lot of ideas, and some of you have forwarded me articles that I would not have known about if it wasn't for your work and time. And I think that's one of the things about this forum and this channel that allows us to move forward. Thanks for joining us.